Techtopia, en podcast om teknologi og mennesker, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Mediehuset Ingeniøren, IBM, KMD, DI's digitaliseringsindsats, Herning Messecenter og IDA Forsikring. Din vært er Henrik Føns.
Techtopia. Velkommen til den anden udgave af Techtopia. Først så vil jeg gerne sige tak til alle dem, som downloadede vores første episode. Det var en fest. Tusind tak for det. Nu skal I bare fortsætte med at lytte med, og så skal I logge jeres kollegaer, venner og familier til også at downloade Techtopia. Måske skal I også lige undervise dem en lille smule i at bruge podcast, men det kan man jo gøre over en kop kaffe eller en håndbajer, og så bliver det måske helt hyggeligt.
Techtopia.
I dag har jeg to historier til jer. Den første handler om tyske robotter. Mange af os grund er lidt nervøse for, om vi bliver automatiseret helt bort af robotter. Ikke mindst når medierne med store overskrifter fortæller os, at 40% af de danske arbejdspladser bliver overtaget af robotter eller kunstig intelligens. Kilden til det var en rapport fra konsulentanalysefirmaet McKinsey. Men måske kan vi bygge en fremtid, der ser anderledes ud. Den tyske robotmager, I skal møde lige om lidt, han ser nemlig sine robotter som et værktøj for mennesker, mere end han ser dem som en trussel. Og så ser fremtiden jo anderledes lys og spændende ud.
Tak, Topier.
Dagens anden historie handler om at få fotos og video til at fylde mindre, og så tænker du måske, nå ja, og hvad så? Men fotos og video står for broderparten af trafikken på nettet, så de sluger en stor kapacitet på mange forskellige måder. Og hvis du bare én gang har skulle rydde op på din harddisk eller din telefon, fordi du har for mange fotos eller videoer, ja, så ved du, hvor irriterende det er, at de fylder så forbandet meget. Og så er der i øvrigt også en sjov forbindelse til satire-tv-serien Silicon Valley, fordi firmaet Beamer er virkelighedens Pied Piper. Mød dem til sidst i Techtopia. For 7 år siden mødte jeg Justin, en blå robot, der boede hos Deutsche Luft- und Raumcenter uden for München, det tyske rumforskningscenter. Justin er egentlig skabt til at arbejde på den internationale rumstation, hvor det kan være svært for mennesker at komme ud og reparere det dyre udstyr. Så tyskerne har lavet en robotarm til brug i rummet. Men min Justin var en butler for mennesker på jorden. Man kan tale til Justin og give ham kommandoer, og han svarer høfligt med sin metalliske stemme, før han udfører opgaven. Umiddelbart kommer man til at tænke på en ond Terminator, når man ser de sorte huller, der er hans kameraøjne. Hans hænder er mere end dobbelt så store som en menneskehånd og har kun 4 fingre. Deres skræmmende størrelse minder om Frankensteins monster. Men når først Justin går i gang med at brygge te, så opdager man, hvor elegant han i virkeligheden er. Hændernes evne til at gribe og holde fast i ting med en meget stor præcision er i virkeligheden den store teknologiske landvinding, man har gjort på rumforskningscenteret. Det kræver nemlig utrolig præcision at arbejde i rummet og skifte reservedele på satellitter. Men Justin nede på jorden, ja, han brygger te fra frysetørret form. Han har en kande med vand, et glas og et glas med frysetørret te. Hele processen med at hælde vand op, drysse en passende mængde te i glasset og servere det, ja, det foregår med en tålmodig finfølelse, som ingen mennesker kan præstere. Vi ville spilde eller vi ville hælde for meget op, og vi ville aldrig kunne lave te på den samme perfekte måde som Justin. Her 7 år senere er teknologien bag denne robot og ikke mindst armen og hænderne udviklet endnu mere og er nu også fundamentet for det private robotfirma Franka, som en ingeniør fra rumforskningscenteret står bag. Han hedder Sami Haddadin.
The arms of Justin were the origins of this idea of technology. So the arms of Justin were named the DLR lightweight robot. So this is they were even robots out of at the outer shell of ISS, some of the joints we had there. Some of my colleagues were working on that. And I've always been pushing the technology towards what I call human-centered robotics. So robots that are really designed for the humans, that are absolutely safe, that are interactive, and at the same time as intuitive as possible. So the notion of UI, UX really already in the how do you talk with the robot or how do you interact with the robot to make this as intuitive as possible? Because obviously it is much more than a smartphone, right? I mean, you take a robot by the hand, you show it something, this has a meaning, right? Just by touching a robot, you give a meaning to the interaction. And also a robot interacting with you has a meaning. And this kind of intuitive interaction was one of our main research focus on top of all the hardcore mechatronics, control, all these hardcore robotics technologies.
Evnen til at sanse og føle verden ligesom et menneske er helt central i Franka-robotten.
So, I mean, it's different in many ways, actually. I even would consider it to be a new generation of robots. So I was originally a researcher at German Aerospace Center, and we developed probably the most advanced research robots worldwide and have a long history and tradition in that sense. Since the 80s, we developed these robots that are supposed to interact with the world, and they are equipped with this sensors that can feel. Right? They really feel contact, they can feel forces, they can understand to a certain extent what is a collision, what is an interaction, did you bump into the robot or is it just currently doing a task? And these things we developed over many years and decades in cutting-edge mechatronics and control. And then we took this to market, and it's very early that these robots are coming. We're actually the first company that really brings out such a robot, and other robots are not equipped with these capabilities. Not only the sensors, but also the, I always call it the central nervous system, right? Which is kind of what makes us so intelligent as humans. We have a perfect symbiosis between our body that is equipped with all this marvelous muscles and tendons and sensors and our central nervous system that makes use of our body and the learning that we put into place. And in fact, Franka is also able to learn, right? So you show it certain things and then it self improves. You show it, for example, how to insert a connector into a plug, and then it improves it such that it minimize the stress on the connector. It tries to do it in minimum time. It really tries to do it as reliable and high quality as possible. So all these things are very new in robotics, and they have always been a dream in robotics. We always wanted to do this, and we were working in research a lot towards this technology, but it was certainly not market ready. And now this is the first generation of robots that can do these things, including all the things like connection of robots, interaction between robots, having thousands of robots basically talking to each other and exchanging information and knowledge in terms of apps and maybe some motor programs.
Franka ligner nu ikke sin forfader Justin særlig meget. Hele kroppen er væk. Tilbage er kun en hvid robotarm, som til gengæld kan håndtere en række forskellige værktøjer, lige fra at gribe ting til at bore huller og trykke på knapper. Og så kan Franka tale med sine brødre og søstre via en cloud service på nettet, hvorfra den også kan fjernstyres.
Yeah, the important thing is obviously I think what we bridged is really the connection between automation of the next generation and the digital world. Because this has always been kind of not well understood how we should do that, and Franka is actually the first robot that was designed from scratch to be a robot of the next century in some sense. So it's actually robot as a service. So Franka is just a service in a distributed service network. So we've got a service-oriented architecture. You can connect computer vision. You can connect anything you would like to the robot. And then basically hook it up, and it's not a monolith, right? We really want to build a community. We want to basically give a tool to people so that they can really make use of a robot in terms of, as I said before, as the PC, right? I mean, the PC was the breakthrough in computation in some sense, because it made it accessible, computation accessible to people, and our approach is really to make robotics accessible to people so that they can actually create something entirely novel with it.
So you want to make it accessible for people?
So it's really important to make it accessible to people because they are actually the creative persons. They can do novel things with robots because they have ideas. You don't come up, right? I mean, everybody has its own notion of what would you do with a robot. And just give people access to robotics, make it affordable for them without sacrificing any of the performance so that you can really get the most advanced robot in the world for the most competitive price and even having the possibility to do whatever you want with it, right? And I think this will create something marvelous that I cannot even think of and maybe not even envision, but I think it's really wonderful to see what other people, or will be wonderful to see what other people will do with the robot. And this is kind of the vision that I have, that really having robots for everybody accessible will create something entirely spectacular that that will just change the world as we see it nowadays. I mean, it's kind of the era of robotics is coming, and this is one of the presumably major steps that brings us there.
Vi lever allerede i robotalderen, siger Sami Haddadin, og derfor så skal en robot kunne programmere sig enhver ved hjælp af apps. Den skal være lige så nem at bruge som en iPhone, er hans budskab.
Franka is designed to be the robot for everybody. So it's really a robot assistant that can be operated by anyone, that can be afforded by anyone, that is safe to interact with. And it's what we call the first a cyber-physical robot that is connected to the cloud, so you basically can program the robot via robot apps, which basically means the robot has capabilities, and you show the robot how to use these apps, and then you can basically deploy this in no time just via using standard cloud systems. I always put a very bold statement saying that Franka is kind of the PC of robotics that is as easy to operate as an iPhone.
Franka ligger i forlængelse af en robot som den amerikanske Baxter, der også er en robot, som ikke er farlig for mennesker. Den nye type robotter skal ud af burerne på fabrikkerne og være sammen med mennesker på fabriksgulvet. De er vores nye kollegaer, og så skal de også kunne lære af os.
So one of the main characteristics of Franka is that it has an artificial sense of touch. So it can actually interact with the environment, so it can really do kind of things that humans are able to do, obviously not by far not as capable as humans are, but we are kind of on the way there. And you can do tasks that really require a sensitive interaction with the environment. And if you look at industrial robotics, they were always good in doing heavy-duty loads, they are good in painting, welding, things like that. And this new generation of robots is now able to do things like assembly, inspection, testing, so it can really physically interact with the world. So all the things that are really laborious, for example, in automobile manufacturing, you could do certain tasks in households, to be frank. I mean, all the things that need interaction with the world. So the whole idea of robots coming out of the cages, so safe robots for humans, means essentially that these robots have to be able to feel and interact. And this is obviously the thing that really makes humans also intelligent, our ability to interact with the world. And this is kind of what we embed into these robots. Obviously, on a very low level of abstraction, we are not at human level at all yet, but we can do lots of things that we do every day, right? I mean, open a door, put the key into the hole, plug in connectors. Think about small and medium enterprises. They have so many of these applications where you just do certain things on a daily basis. You sometimes change it depending on the demand of the of your customer, and you just reprogram these robots very efficiently and very easily, basically without any expertise, and they are able to do things that weren't possible before, essentially.
Men hvis man sammenligner med smartphones, så kan det jo godt være, at vi alle sammen har den samme telefon. Men når man åbner den, så ophører ligheden, fordi vi har forskellige apps. Spørgsmålet er, om Franka også vil have sådan et individuelt udtryk, ligesom en telefon har.
Well, let's say the robot hardware is the platform. So if you want to do something else with the robot, you want to create a new app, then we actually release a developer's kit that anyone can become a robot programmer and develop their own apps, develop their own business cases. So if you have a different application, you either do it by yourself, essentially, or you use all the different apps that we already provide, which are very capable, so you can do lots of tasks with that already. And the interesting thing, and what is the big difference, obviously, between a robot and a smartphone, is you can combine apps, right? So you've got app A and app B, and you can just concatenate them, you can put one after the other, you can make entirely new kind of process change with the existing apps. Its reusability basically the composition of apps is very easy, and it's there for the first time, actually.
So it sounds like sort of a plug-and-play programming language.
It is, actually. So, in fact, we developed an entire new programming language that is not comparable to anything that has been there before. And why did we do that? In some sense, there were programming languages for, let's call it, the classical industrial robotics, but these new type of robots, they have so many more things to offer. They can do so many different things that, obviously, all the things that other robots could do before, the classical industrial ones, so they are very accurate, they can do all kinds of tasks. But with this new language of touch, in some sense, right, you need to embed this into the programming. So a robot needs to understand what it means to interact with the world, and this obviously has to be reflected in the programming language, and obviously also in the app that you use and that you program.
I disse år er der masser af bekymrede rapporter og stemmer, når det handler om automatisering af arbejdspladser. Men Sami Haddadin hører ikke til de bekymrede. Han mener tværtimod, at mennesker får et bedre arbejdsliv gennem at samarbejde med robotter.
I totally disagree. I think our robots will create incredibly many jobs, and they are really not autonomous robots in the sense that they will just be exchanged of work labor. They are more like a toolbox, so they actually enhance humans. So a human has the possibility to do something that was not possible before, and he can focus on new things. I mean, I just gave the example of nursing. We cannot, and we don't want to do nursing, right? I mean, we want to support, to do the things that actually prevent you from doing your job, right? This is exactly what I think is a crucial factor. And we were talking about SMEs. There are so many aspects about SMEs. They would, if they would have access to automation, to this kind of automation, they can actually take new orders. They can actually deliver to the market. They can increase their work labor, which they simply don't have. They really have the need for new work labor. And to be honest, in Germany, for example, we really have problems that we don't have enough people who could do the job, right? Especially night shifts and so on. So you just let the robot do the parts of the task that are really dull and laborious, and you can then really add humans and robots. So it's really about humans and robots being a team instead of being substitutes. The whole philosophy is really designed for being a support to humans. I actually think that this can also be a breakthrough in personal robotics, especially in healthcare. What I see really, we have that in Germany, but we've got this all over the world, is that nursing staff is really kind of occupied with things that they are not supposed to do. So I believe that the healthcare sector can be revolutionized by robotics in terms of we can actually relieve nursing staff from all these duties that are just kind of taking their time, eating it up, and taking it away from them instead of interacting with the people that need care. And the nurse or the healthcare systems worldwide are just entirely sub-financed, so there is really the pressure that they have to be highly economical and so on, and they basically have no time for their patients anymore. And this is, I think, something that could really change, be a game changer in that field as well.
Men der er også stadig ting, som robotter ikke kan. For eksempel så er tøj og blødt stof stadig en udfordring. En robot er stadig rigtig, rigtig dårlig til at folde et håndklæde.
Hardware development is much more resource intensive in the development phase, so it takes really skilled people to actually do hardware development. And there is not kind of this broad number of mechatronics engineers. You don't have the resources often. It's much easier to develop a software business also by means of a business case, right? So if you want to develop a robot, it's a very large investment you need to put, not only by means of money, but also by means of time, and also by means of people you need for this kind of development. And there are just so many yet open problems in robotics, and this is speaking, the researcher speaking, right? That we know that there is an inherent limit in terms of the body. So regardless how fast the software grows, the body still has to deliver in some sense. And if you want to do a task, and let's take tower folding for example, I mean, we would consider this to be trivial as humans. For robotics, it's like a holy grail to be able to do that. And there has been some videos and research. I think it takes like 30 minutes to basically fold a towel for one time in this particular setting, and it's far off from anything that I guess we would imagine to work in real life.
Vi taler ofte om Moores lov og regnekraften i computere, der udvikler sig eksponentielt. De kan mere og mere uden at stige i pris. Men kan man sige det samme om robotter? Det er jo avanceret hardware og præcisionsværktøj.
Being a researcher, I think I quite well understand where we are at the moment and what we can do and especially what we cannot do. And there's many things we simply are not able to do at the current stage. So robots are simply not there. So for example, I always give the example of handling and manipulating flexible materials such as clothes. We are not there. We cannot do it. It's a totally open problem in robotics. And obviously this means we can only do parts of the things that are useful. And I think it's really, robotics is a lot about embodiment, about hardware, about the body has to be able to do it, right? If the body is in principle not able to do it, then the software cannot help, right? And it's not all about software and robotics. Robotics is really the perfect symbiosis of the body and the mind. And we are in the early stage still in robotics, and as you might know, we have about 200,000 to 300,000 sold units a year of industrial robotics. So this is not a huge number if you think about it. And if you think about all the work that we're doing that is really, and let's put it worldwide, we have so many jobs that are really considered slavery in our continent. I think it's really important that we make it accessible to everybody, because this will give them the similar transformations we already have behind us to a certain extent in Europe or the US, and especially in Japan. And this is really something that I believe is kind of the democratization of automation that will give people the access to that and also the responsible usage of that technology. And this whole discussion about exponential growth, being also a mechatronics person and knowing how much time it took us to develop the hardware platform and knowing how many failed doing the same thing, I think it's quite safe to say that this is a tool, this is not a substitute. It will enhance humans. It will be something that really will make our lives easier and better and create, I think, entirely new industries, to be honest. I mean, to be frank, robotics will be bigger than the internet, bigger than the smartphones, and presumably bigger than the PC. I mean, if we think about the future, if we think about the now, it is a tool that can be tremendously useful to people in many, many ways. And if we can help supporting elderly, if we can help supporting people from doing dangerous jobs.
For Sami Haddadin handler det også om at sætte Tyskland i spidsen for robotudvikling. Amerikanerne, de tog internettet. Robotterne skal tilhøre Tyskland, siger han.
What I always think is really important, especially if we talk about robotics, because we had a little bit the problem in Germany when the internet came. We kind of lost a little bit the connection to it in the beginning. So especially young people were not push towards being educated in that field. So I actually believe we should really put a lot of emphasis on education of our children and students, and this is where I put a lot of emphasis on as a teacher in the university, to really educate them as early as possible so that they see possibilities, they see the risk as well, right? I mean, we need to educate them on both sides. They need to understand what good can we do with robotics, which things shouldn't we do, right? And how can they be like robotic natives in some sense, right? How can we give them the tools to shape our future in the next 100 years? And I think we cannot start early enough, because otherwise we kind of lose a possibility here, I believe. And I just gave a talk, it's called Pupils University. It was really wonderful a couple of months ago in front of 510-year-old, and I was amazed, truly amazed, how much they knew about robots. So I actually brought some robots and let them experience it, and they told me anything about robotics. They had no fear. They had all the understanding of what robots can do, what can they not do, and it was a truly exceptional experience. And it was really nice to see that they think about what they can do with robotics and what robots could do for them, right? And this is something we can only embrace and really try to make this the future of our children, I believe.
Hvis du gerne vil se robotten Franka i aktion, så besøg vores hjemmeside tektopia.dk, hvor jeg linker til firmaet bag, som også har en meget fin video med Franka. Jeg har også fundet en video med en interessant paneldebat om automatisering og robotter, som Sami Haddadin deltog i på konferencen DLD i München i januar måned.
Silicon Valley is the cradle of innovation.
Your compression algorithm blew our engineering team away.
We have the resources to take what you have done to the global level.
I'm prepared to give you $200,000.
$600,000
for 10% of your company.
$10 million.
What do you guys do here?
What do we do? All those U-porn ones and zeros streaming directly to your shitty little smartphone. Every dipshit who shits his pants if he can't get Skrillex in under 12 seconds. It's not magic, it's talent and sweat. That's what the fuck we do.
Hvis man følger med i satire-tv-serien Silicon Valley, så ved man, at nørden Richard laver startupen Pied Piper, baseret på hans algoritme, der kan komprimere videofiler til en meget lille størrelse uden tab af billedkvalitet. Han kan altså lave filerne mindre, så de fylder mindre, når de skal streames eller ligge på en harddisk. En opfindelse, som er mange penge værd. Det er fiktion, men som altid så henter fiktionen sin inspiration i virkeligheden. Virkelighedens Pied Piper ligger dog ikke i Californien, men i Israel, og firmaet hedder Beamer, og de komprimerer også video.
We were very happy when this series came out. Because before it came out, we had to tell people, yes, we reduce the size and it doesn't hurt the quality, etc. Now all we have to say, you know, Pied Piper from the Silicon Valley TV series, we're just the real Pied Piper. Now, the thing is, when I come to think of it, why did the scriptwriters of Silicon Valley select a company that compresses images and videos and music? Because they were thinking of a problem that is so difficult to solve that a startup that solved this problem would be very valuable and be the best startup in the world. So they said, okay, if we could take, and they probably consulted with experts because I know that a lot of technology experts work as advisors to the series, and they said, what's the hardest problem? What's like impossible to do? So what's impossible to do is to take images, video, and music that are already compressed and to reduce their size further, like by half, and without having any impact on the video or image itself. Now, this exact problem is, of course, impossible to solve. If all the pixels remain as there is, then it's impossible to reduce it by a further 50% beyond the current state of technology. So what we do reduce the file size of images and video. The pixels are not exactly the same, but they are perceptually the same. So to a human viewer, our image and video files would look the same as the source image and video files, but we manage to hide those differences in places where the human eye cannot see. My name is Dror Gil. I'm the CTO and VP product at Beamer. Beamer is a technology startup that develops technology for image and video optimized compression. And we sell our technology to large service providers and online social network that are image intensive and video intensive for optimizing all of their images and video.
And when you say optimizing, could you explain to us, how do you actually do it?
So the process of optimizing an image or a video is reducing its file size without compromising the quality in any way. So we can take a video file and reduce its size up to 50% without any effect on quality. And we do this using a very unique quality measure that we developed that has very high correlation with human vision. So this quality measure can actually tell us whether two images or video frames would look the same to a human viewer or not. And based on this quality measure, in an iterative process, we go frame by frame on the video and compress each frame to the optimal level, which is smaller than the original but still has the same quality.
It still has the same quality, but you're actually removing information from both the video and the picture. So you're sort of fooling the human eye?
Right. We're removing information that a human viewer would not be able to see, would not be able to detect. So there is some redundancy there that is left after the original compression of the video, and we completely remove that redundancy. And that's how we managed to reduce the file size of images and video by a further 20 to 50% after they've already been compressed.
Why is this important?
This is important because it reduces the amount of space you need to store your images and videos and the amount of bandwidth you need in order to consume those videos. So for images, for example, we have a consumer program, which is an app for PC and Mac, that's called JPEG Mini. Once you install JPEG Mini on your computer, you can drag a folder with all of your photos, and suddenly it will free up dozens of gigabytes of disk space from your computer or laptop. And then it does it in a way that your photos remain in full resolution and no quality loss. So you actually gain free space on your computer, which is very useful because we all know your hard disk, especially on your laptop, no matter how big it is, it always fills up. And in the video domain, the main benefit that we're providing is to cable operators, satellite operators, and over-the-top video streaming companies, because the amount of bandwidth occupied by video after optimization is lower. So they're saving on their bandwidth cost, but they're also improving the user experience. So you as a customer will also benefit. If you get video on your service, like Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime Video, that has been optimized by Beamer, then it takes up less bandwidth, so it flows more smoothly over the network. So what you as a consumer will witness is a faster start of the stream and less buffering events, less of those annoying buffering events that happen during the playback of your video.
Now, the way you explain it, it sounds so simple, but I mean, what's the technology behind it? I mean, how did you come up with the idea? What kind of research lies behind it?
So we wanted to reduce the bitrate and the storage requirement for images and videos. But very quickly we understood that the real problem is an image quality measure. Because anybody can just compress to a lower bitrate or reduce the file size by varying a compression parameter. But how much can you vary this parameter? When do you need to stop? When will a human viewer be able to detect that you overcompressed that image or video? This is the question we asked ourselves, and that's why we came to the conclusion that what we actually need to develop is a quality measure. So this development was done across a time span of around 4 to 5 years, and until now, on all the technology developed in Beamer, we have 25 granted patents and 30 more are pending, because the technology is really very deep in identifying the exact artifacts that are annoying to the human eye.
Does it work on your smartphone?
So we already have demos of a library both for Android and iOS, which compresses images on the phone itself. And we also have a web uploader. So if you go from your desktop PC and upload images to your favorite photo service for albums or printing or whatever, the upload itself is faster because you don't upload the original image, you upload the image after Beamer optimization. After JPEG Mini, technology by Beamer has optimized that images. And web services around the world are starting to use our uploader, and they're finding that consumers are now uploading more photos. It takes them less time, so there's less chance that they will abandon the upload in the middle, what happens a lot because of bandwidth issues. So they're seeing clear benefits of optimizing those images. And our next step is really to bring it to the mobile devices, and then over the cellular network, which has even more limited bandwidth than your broadband at home, you'll be able to upload much more, many more full resolution images using less bandwidth. And this not only saves you bandwidth and cellular data cost, it also saves you power. Because when you upload an image, let's say for 15 seconds, it consumes the modem of your cellular device for 15 seconds. If suddenly this upload takes only 5 seconds, then it's a third of the power consumption for that modem function. So actually, when you use optimized images during your upload, you also increase the battery life of your phone. So that's where we're going next, moving it into the mobile space.
Her hørte du Dror Gil fra Beamer. Vi linker til dem fra tektopia.dk.
Tektopia.
Du har lyttet til Tektopia. Vi høres ved på næste mandag, hvor jeg dukker op i dit podcast feed.
Tektopia.
I mellemtiden kan du skrive til os på tektopia@ida.dk, eller du kan besøge hjemmesiden tektopia.dk. Du kan også finde os på facebook.com/tektopia.dk eller følge os på Twitter, hvor vi hedder @tektopia.dk. På genhør i næste uge.
Tektopia, en podcast om teknologi og mennesker, udgivet af Ingeniørforeningen IDA i samarbejde med Mediehuset Ingeniøren, IBM, KMD, DI's digitaliseringsindsats, Herning Messecenter og IDA Forsikring. Din vært er Henrik Føns.
Tektopia.